Last time we left off in Isaiah 46 at the fourth verse, we just gotten through the fourth verse. So tonight we want to begin with this fifth verse, Isaiah 46. And as we mentioned, we'd like to get through, if we can, the 46th and 47th chapters tonight. The subject here in this 46th chapter of Isaiah is the folly that Israel has fallen into by trusting in idolatry. And so in verse 5, he's making a comparison now between himself, God is, and the idols. He says, "To whom will you liken me, and make me equal, and compare me, that we may be like?" And when you stop and think about the power and the majesty of God in heaven, there is just no other being or no other institution or creature that you can possibly compare to God. Who could you liken or compare to God? Who you make equal with God? Who you make to be like God? And so that question is designed, I'm sure, to provoke anyone to think, if they are serving some other thing besides the true and living God, to stop and think, what kind of a comparison is it here? Then in verse 6, he begins to describe the procedure used in acquiring and making idols. They lavish gold out of the bag, and weigh silver in the balance, and hire a goldsmith, and he maketh it a god. They fall down, yea, they worship. So they use such items as gold. So lavish it out of the bag would mean that you pour it out of the bag that you are carrying it in. And to weigh silver in the balance is a way of measuring out silver to see what the quantity and value of it is. And they hire a goldsmith, and then he maketh it a god. Here's silver that was once in a bag, gold that was once in a bag, and silver that was weighed out. And then here they hire a goldsmith, and he takes these metallic items and turns them into a god, and they worship it. They fall down and worship it. So just to stop and observe the procedure that's gone through in the making of a god or of an idol, that alone is enough to make anybody have serious doubts as to the validity of worshiping this thing. It can't be God. It can't be the Creator. It can't be the supreme being of the universe. Then he further describes them in verse 7. They bear him upon the shoulder. They carry him and set him in his palace, or rather in his place. And he standeth. From his place shall he not remove. Yea, one shall cry unto him, yet can he not answer, nor save him out of his trouble. Now this is another description of idolatrous gods, and it shows how utterly foolish it is to place any kind of spiritual value upon them. They bear him on the shoulder, they carry him. They set him in his place, and he standeth. Now, it's like a wooden log of some kind. You set it up there, and it just stands there. From his place shall he not remove. He can't move, he can't go any place. Yea, one shall cry unto him, yet he cannot answer, nor save him out of his trouble. You can cry to him, you can pray to him, you can plead your case. He can't even answer because he's not hearing you. And so this shows really what people are serving when they are serving an idolatrous god. Now this verse 7 here reminds me of another passage that I'd like to turn to and read in Jeremiah 10. Jeremiah is just the next book, so if you've got your Bible, turn on over to Jeremiah. Jeremiah, the 10th chapter, beginning with the first verse. Jeremiah 10, verse 1. Hear ye the word which the Lord speaketh unto you, O house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. Now let's see what he's saying here. Learn not the way of the heathen. The heathen is the person, of course, who is not God's people. He's the person who is not counted as spiritual. He's someone who is living completely the natural life and has nothing to do with the spiritual life. Now, he says to learn not the way of the heathen. And he's going to tell us here what the way of the heathen is. Learn not the way of the heathen. And he also says, be not dismayed at the signs of heaven. Now, these signs of heaven, that's the study of astrology, attributing certain powers to the heavens and the signs there. And he says that the heathen are dismayed at them. In other words, don't let these heavenly bodies, the different orbits that they get into and so on, don't let that cause you any distress. That is not the way that God intends for us to know about His will or to know about our lives. But it's a part of sorcery and magic and all of the things that go with the heathen. The heathen are dismayed at these signs, he says. Well, then he goes on down in verse 3. For the customs of the people are vain. Now, this is part of the ways of the heathen that we're not supposed to learn. He says, the customs of the people are vain. Now, the word vain means worthless, useless. And now he describes this custom. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. They are upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They must needs be born, because they cannot go. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither also is it in them to do good. Now, the description that he's given here is that of an idol. But you'll notice in this King James Version, it is remarkably similar to the act of putting up a Christmas tree. Here it's a tree that's cut out of the forest. It's cut with an axe. They have to carry it. They stand it upright. They nail it down with hammers. Take hammers and nail it so that it stays in the place. They deck it with silver and gold. It stands upright like the palm tree. And on. This is a description of a custom, of a practice of the people that they were doing way back in the time of Jeremiah, which is hundreds of years before Christ. And he says that it's a vain custom. It is a way not to learn. Learn not the way of the heathen, he says. Then he further describes these trees that are standing up like this. He says, be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither also is it in them to do good. That is, they can't hurt you, but they can't help you. There's no way that this thing can't do anything. It is absolutely helpless to do anything. It can't do any kind of action at all. Now, our taking that and using it in some kind of a adoration or worship or ritual that we would go through, that then might cause us to be hurt because we're taking something in the place of what God wants us to take. But it's very remarkable that this description is given here of a practice that did exist way back then and has continued right down to the present time, that of putting up what we now call a Christmas tree. Well, let's go back to Isaiah 46 now. And talking about this idol, he says, they bear him on the shoulder, they carry him, they set him in the place, and he standeth. From his place he shall not be removed, yea, one shall cry unto him, yet he cannot answer, nor save him out of his trouble. So in verse 8 he says, remember this. Remember what I'm saying. Keep this in mind. This is something that's important. This information that I'm giving you now is information that's going to be needed for you, and it's going to bear you in good stead as you go through your life. Remember this. And show yourselves men. Now this phrase, show yourselves men, is very similar to a phrase that we find in 1 Corinthians 16:13. I'm going to turn to that just a minute and read it. 1 Corinthians 16:13. There the Apostle Paul says, watch ye, stand fast in the faith, quit you like men, be strong. Now that phrase there, quit you like men, or show yourselves men, simply means to behave like men. Behave like somebody who is now in a mature, adult, responsible state. And, of course, we as individuals now, we have childhood state and an adult state. You know, we read in the New Testament about the church going through a childhood state and then later the adult state. But here he's talking about the practice of these people, and as long as they were using and serving and looking to the idols, they were in an immature childhood state. And now to come out of that kind of a practice and to really get into the spiritual realm as the Bible would have us to be in, causes us to go through a certain amount of maturing then that gets us out of these childish, immature behavior. And so that's what he's saying here. He said, remember this and show yourselves men. That is, you act in a mature manner. You act like men should act. And as we said, there are many things that are childhood and manhood phases that have those phases. The nations have, the church had, individuals have. And even today, you know, whenever a person grows up and has an adult body, but he still or she still is immature, still is living in a little immature world of their own, they completely make havoc of their lives by not being able to act in a mature manner. And this causes everything from a person to desert his family, to not being able to keep a job, committing hideous crimes, simply because of not getting into a mature state of mind. Well, in a spiritual state, this idolatry is a childish thing. And so to get out of it, you're going to have to act like or show yourselves men. And he further says in verse 8, bring it again to mind, O ye transgressors. Remember what has been said about idolatry. Bring it to mind again. And you know, we've already read a lot on this subject in Isaiah that seems to be repeating itself a lot. But as you look around and you see people still guilty, still committing these idolatrous rituals that are so condemned here, then no wonder it is repeated over and over, because it is necessary for us to have this brought to our remembrance even. We're continually confronted with it. Every day there is probably some kind of an opportunity for us to allow ourselves to be taken in by some of this idolatrous behavior. And so he tells us to bring it again to mind, O ye transgressors. Now, he's talking here to the nation of Israel, who had transgressed, who had become guilty of idolatry. He said, bring it to mind again. Remember these things. So in verse 9, remember the former things of old. And he's really saying to remember the past events. Remember the things that God has done for you. Do not forget those original truths that you knew way back there. Don't get off into some new and modernistic, ungodly way. But remember the things of old, or the former things. Now this is a very good admonition for us today, to remember the former things of old. Because as we think back about the establishment of the church, which was established about 33 A.D. or so, which has been some 1900 years ago, as we think back about the establishment of it, we see there that God set the pattern for how the church should be from then on. The pattern was cast. There were some things about the church that was to change, but he explained those changes in his word. And here again, we can see the true picture of how the real church should be today. And this causes us then necessarily, in order to see this picture, we have to remember the former things of old. We have to be able to remember how God originally set the church to be. And then when we see how man has changed it and perverted it and distorted it for his own good and his own ends, then we see how far the church then, or the false church, has deviated from what the true church really is. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me. Now, of course, we've had that sentiment expressed several times, and it's well for us to be reminded of it again and again. I am God, and there is none else. There is just not any other God but me. Now you turn from me, you leave me, and you don't have anything. It's not a matter of taking something that's lesser in value, something that's going to be a little bit inferior, something that's not going to give you quite as much good. It's a matter of not having anything. There is none else. And so it's a matter, you know, of worshiping God or worshiping a stick. That's really what it boils down to, and the difference in value. There's not anybody else but me. So you remember these things. Declaring the end from the beginning. That is, way back whenever a sequence of events are just beginning, God is already telling what the end's going to be. He can tell you what the outcome will be, and He's done it in His prophecies many times. He declares the end while He's still at the beginning. And from ancient times, the things that are not yet done. That is, He told things way back, things that were going to come to pass, which have not yet come to pass, saying, My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Now let's think of those last two phrases there just for a moment. God is saying, My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. And the word pleasure here really means will. I'm going to do what my will is. Now as we stop and think about this just for a moment. My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure, or all my will. God is simply saying here that the things that I have said that are going to happen, the plan that I have instituted for man, the purposes that I have outlaid for man to follow, they're going to stand. And I will do all of my pleasure. And this shows me several things. Number one, if God made a statement like this and is standing behind it, then whatever it is that God has for His will, for His plan, if we're going to be saved, we're going to have to follow His plan. Whatever He has for His plan then, He is not going to change it. And you know, it's real easy now for us to get into our minds the idea, well now here I am a good moral person. God really knows that I have good motives and I have good intentions and I really want to be saved, and I am really, truly sincere about this thing. And so God will probably just kind of change things around here so that I can fit in. He's not going to change anything for us. If He, all through this history of time, if He has required mankind to follow strictly and straightly what He wanted to have done, those that did not obey His will, He has absolutely not yielded to them at all. He's not allowed them to change His plan. And they've gone on down into the grave wrong because God wouldn't change His plan to fit their lives. Do you think He's going to change it now for us? He's required all of this vast number of people now to fall into whatever His will is or else be in His disfavor. All the world has been required to do this. And I hear He's going to make an exception in 1978 for me. He's going to change things now for me. Not so. His plan, He said, my plan is going to stand. And I'll do all of my will. I'll do all of my pleasure. It's going to stand. It will not be altered. It will not be changed nor shaken. My plan is going to be carried through. Here He had a whole nation carried into captivity simply because they weren't following according to His plan to punish them, to chastise them, to get them out of idolatry. And we think for a moment that God's going to make an exception in our case. In Revelation we read about those souls under the altar who have been martyred because that they were followers of Christ. And they're crying under the altar there, saying, how long, O Lord, how long before we're going to be avenged? That is, as they followed God's plan, and as they didn't yield from it, and they were put to death because they followed it, and they're asking God how long it's going to be before He avenges those that do not follow His plan? We're going to come along and say in the face of all that, now God, You make an exception for me. I'm really basically a good person, and I like me a whole lot, and I think You're going to like me too. So You change things up so that I can make it on my way. It's not going to be that way. We need to realize that it's us. We're the ones who are going to have to conform. We're the ones who are going to have to change and mold and be molded into whatever His plan is. Because His plan will not change for us. So as we know this then, as we begin to discover what His plan is, what the plan of salvation is, what God's will is for us, as we begin to discover these things, then it gives us a sense of security knowing that we're in the right way. Knowing that we're doing the thing that God would have us to do, this makes us secure. Because this plan, once we get in accordance with it, once we're living according to the way that it is not going to change. It's not going to be shaken. It's not going to be altered. Man's not going to deter it. If we're according to it, then we're according to all that's right. Everything that's ever been created in the universe. And it's going according to God's natural laws and according to the laws of science and physics and mathematics and chemistry and so on. All of these laws that are in harmony, we then find ourselves in harmony with them because we're with God's plan. We're going according to what His plan is. So the big job for us then is to find out what is His plan. What does He want us to do? What are we required to do? What are His demands upon us? Or His requirements? Or His requests? Once we get in line with those, then what a secure thing it is. What a sense of security it is to know His plan is not going to change. He says, "My counsel shall stand, and I will do all of My pleasure." And this brings us to another question up I'd like to just interject here. Why did God go to all of the trouble with these people of Israel to send them off into captivity and then to punish the Babylonians and have His people freed from captivity? Why did He go to all that trouble and even bother with them? Why didn't He just forget about these people? Well, because God had made a promise to these people and He had committed Himself to them. And if there was any way possible that He could carry through with His promise, then He's going to do it. And the only possible way was to purge them from their sin. And so He goes to all ends, all lengths, to purge them from their sins. So that He then can carry through with His promise to them. And as we stop and think about justice, here's somebody who is guilty of a crime and needs to be punished. Justice doesn't lose anything by waiting a while before it gives the punishment. If the punishment's going to come, as they deserve it, then justice can wait. They can be punished today or they can be punished 10 years from now and still justice will have been done. Well, this then allows God to wait on our punishment. When we're guilty, God can wait about punishing us. And if we then become in a non-guilty state before we actually get the punishment, justice has still been done. And if we never become non-guilty, He still will eventually punish us. So God can be long-suffering. He can wait. He can allow us to see His plan and to change our lives, and then it hasn't interfered with His justice at all because He's just waiting before the punishment comes when we finally then cease to be guilty. And so we can go through all kinds of gyrations here trying to get Israel to get free of their sin so He can carry out His plan with them. And so it is with us today. God can be long-suffering with us today, and He is long-suffering with us. We're allowed to live maybe year after year after year, living a life of total abject spiritual depravity. And God lets us go on with it. Because ultimately, if we will just repent, then He's been glorified in the end. Injustice has been done by waiting. And yet if we still remain evil, justice will be done by us having to be punished eventually. Well, back to our text now. He says, "My counsel will stand and I will do all My pleasure." And there's a colon after the word pleasure, which means He's going to further explain now what part of His pleasure includes here. Verse 11, "calling a ravenous bird from the east." Now this ravenous bird from the east is Cyrus, that we've talked about several times before. And the east here would be referring to the country from whence he came, which was Persia. So He's calling Cyrus from the east now to do His will. And this phrase, ravenous bird, is an interesting phrase. Some of the Bible scholars even think that it has to do with the fact that Cyrus had a big eagle as his standard. And as he went into battle, this eagle was the symbol of his force and of his power. That might be what the ravenous bird could have a double meaning, but really he's still referring to Cyrus. Then he further describes him. the man that executeth my counsel from a far country. This is Cyrus, who's carrying out God's counsel now. It doesn't mean that Cyrus was a righteous man. It doesn't mean that Cyrus was a God-fearing man. But it does mean that Cyrus was a perfect instrument for God doing what he wanted to do with him. What was he doing? He was punishing the nation of Babylon, and he was allowing then his people to be set free who had been captives for 70 years. That's what it was really all about. Yea, I have spoken it. I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it. I will also do it. Now, this is spoken, as we mentioned earlier, some 150 years before this thing happened. Long time before it happened, and God is talking about it now like it's already happened, like it's already been done. He's describing how it's going to happen, and he speaks of it as though he's already accomplished the fact, and they haven't even been taken into captivity at this time. So in verse 12 he says, "Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted, that are far from righteousness." Now this is simply a warning to the disobedient to listen to me. Listen to what I'm saying, God says. Ye stout-hearted. Now stout-hearted here really refers to those that are obstinate, those that are opposed to whatever God wants, and they're hard to get to change their will. He says, "Listen to me, ye that are far from righteousness. I will bring near my righteousness." Now the word righteousness here really means his truth or the fulfilling of his promises or of his prophecies. "I will bring near my righteousness. It shall not be far off, and my salvation shall not tarry. And I will place salvation in Zion for Israel my glory." Now that verse 13 is just a little prophetic, symbolic stating of what God is going to do. "I'll bring near my righteousness," that is, "I'll fulfill my promises. They'll not be far off," and certainly it wasn't far off before this began to happen. "And my salvation shall not tarry," that is, when I rescue you from Babylon, I won't wait about doing it. When the time comes, I'm going to do it. "And I will place salvation in Zion." Now Zion, of course, was the area where Jerusalem was. "I'll place salvation in Zion for Israel my glory." Now this word Zion, not only did it mean Jerusalem, but it's also another phrase for the church. Today it's the church. Back in the Old Testament times, it was Jerusalem. And so he says, "I'll place salvation in Zion." That's where they had to go for their salvation, was in Zion. That's where God intended for them to go. And he said, "It's for Israel my glory." Israel, of course, is another name for God's people. And God's people always will be found in the church or in Zion. And that's where salvation is found. You don't get salvation outside of the church, and you don't find God's people outside of the church or outside of Zion. That's where they're going to be. In Acts 2:47, he says, "And the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved." Any who become such as should be saved are then added to the church by the Lord daily. It doesn't have to be any special time. It can happen any day. Then he says, "For Israel my glory." And the word glory here probably means that Israel are reflecting the glory of God. They either are reflecting the glory of God by teaching what His will is to others, or they are reflecting the glory of God by living a righteous, holy life, and there somebody can see what God's glory is, that it's reflected by His children as they live the way He wants them to. Now let's go into chapter 47.